send in the Marines! Ripley's got the power loader!
How's that grab you?
All the firepower a Marine could ask for! When things get buggy, sting them with the stinger!
Rock 'em and rope 'em!
Ugly aliens getting you down?
Send in the Marines!
Aliens!
Podcast Dark Horse Presents Aliens. Deactivating language censorship. Warning, spoilers activated. Engaging.
Planet of the Apes was the first big film franchise to recognize the potential in merchandising. You can look to its Go Ape marketing plan. George Lucas learned the lessons of Planet of the Apes to create the Star Wars line through Kenner eventually. Action figures have remained a staple of children's toys ever since, and especially with the phenomenon that was Star Wars, there was a desire to try to come up with more lines based on sci-fi franchises, including Kenner's ill-fated attempt to do alien action figures. The only thing that was ever released was an 18-inch xenomorph. It was basically decided that these things were too creepy and phallic to be sold to children, which is probably why they didn't have a line ready for the 1986 Aliens sequel. Hugely successful, despite being an R rating, popular with kids, but there were no toys to play with, so you basically take your G.I. Joes and you do your best Aliens knockoffs. After years of production hell, another sequel finally came out, and the intention was to have a line of action figures to go along with Alien 3. Problem being that Alien 3 didn't know what it was going to be until it finally got made. So it's kind of hard to riff off a movie with a script that's in constant flux, that's gone through multiple directors. So it looks like elements of Fox and Kenner took point on a project called Operation Aliens. This was intended to be an animated series along the lines of, again, G.I. Joe, X-Men, that sort of thing, planned to run on the Fox Kids line. There's a lot of debate about how far that project got along. For years, there was a myth about there being an animated pilot that never aired. As it turned out, there were frames created by Will Muneau that were intended for a commercial for the toys that was never fully produced. So it had been something similar to what G.I. Joe had back in the 80s, where you'd have that little snippet of a comic book. Given the very short shelf life of comic books, the fact is the only reason why that existed was because at that time they were prohibited for doing animation to support a toy line. So you have a comic book commercial that allows you to do animation for it, and it just so happens to be tied into a toy line. So it was a workaround, essentially. There was a lot of hesitancy about doing anything with the Aliens toy line because of the adult nature of the movies. That didn't stop RoboCop, clearly, but there were also some laws that were put into place in the early 90s that impeded the progress of this project. Eventually, the Operation Aliens cartoon toy line just morphed into the Aliens action figures, and pretty much the only way we know how Operation Aliens would have turned out is by looking to the comic books that were packaged with the action figures from the first two series of the Aliens line in 1992.
Aliens! They're unstoppable! But we're gonna stop them anyway! Send in the Marines!
We're the Space Marines! Drake, Ripley, Aphone, Bishop, and I'm Hicks, armed with the latest high-tech heavy metal.
Look out, Hicks! The Queen's gonna crown ya!
My bug rocker's on a roll!
Full alien attacking! Eat torch, bug brain!
Alien invasion problem? Send in the Marines!
Aliens!
Send in the Marines!
Space Marines!
Marvel Comics recently repackaged those comic books in their Aliens, the Original Years Omnibus Volume 1. That's where I finally read them. It's a substantial book, by the way, although it's an omnibus, it almost goes without saying. And they had to get somewhat creative in the presentation because, unlike the mini comics that I grew up with, like with Master of the Universe and Superpowers, they were just really small comic books in dimension. Kenner took an unusual tack into having their comics be square rather than rectangular. That works well enough on an actual comic book page by turning it into a six-panel grid, but that also means that, if anything, I think that the comic is reproduced smaller than the original books were. So for an aging fellow like me, it's hard to read these things. You're also keenly aware of the limitations of a square versus a rectangle. It's extremely hard to pack a lot of panels into a square. So typically it would either be a splash image or a two panel grid within the comic book itself. Anytime they tried to go for more than two panels, it was extraordinarily horrible. And because of the limitations of that square presentation, you can't can't do much in terms of dynamism with a panel layout. Probably the strongest attempts was when they were just do a diagonal line with two pieces of action on the same page. You're not going to get any Neil Adams or early 90s kind of crazy stuff going on with this. There's just no room for it. The books were produced by Dark Horse Comics, who were able to promote themselves through them with their little icon. So that had to be a bit of a coup for them. It's, of course, notable that because of the ongoing Aliens movies, the actual Dark Horse Comics weren't able to use Ripley very often for very long. You still got your Aliens fixed by having Hicks and Newt in most of the early stories, but the absence of Ripley was always keenly felt in those stories. With the toy line, you would think that this would be an excellent opportunity for them to finally explore the Ripley character, but again, this was a toy tie-in, and I'm sure there were men in positions of power who thought that a line geared toward a female protagonist would hinder their ambitions. In particular, there's a poster and a carrying case with Operation Aliens branding, which very curiously foregrounds of all characters Drake. Now, I think Sergeant Drake was a cool looking character in the Aliens movie. Regardless, he's killed in the first confrontation with the aliens. The Colonial Marines who survived that encounter are saved by Ripley. She's the heroine of the movie. And while I would definitely have a bone of contention with them foregrounding Hicks, it's especially weird that it's Drake. More interestingly, for me at least, what I found is that the comic books that Dark Horse produced actually foreground the Apone character. Sergeant Apone is the troop leader on the ground. As a result, that character got a lot of dialogue in the early part of the movie. He's a commanding presence, actor did a great job, but he's also lost in the first confrontation. So clearly this is an alternate universe. The events of, I'm not even sure if LV-426 is ever explicitly referenced in the comic books without going back through it again. They do reference Acheron. Certainly events happened there that had an impact on the characters, but they didn't die, at least in this reality.
I launched this podcast on the 35th anniversary of the movie Aliens. And people don't really celebrate 35th anniversaries. You know, it's like 30, yeah. 35 is just halfway to 40, and that's all it is. But I did something for the 30th anniversary of Alien. Now, it's kind of funny because probably the main thing I'm known for in fan circles is being a fan of Martian Manhunter. Ran a blog for that character for years, and it's ironic too because Martian Manhunter fan, Aliens fan, I don't actually believe in aliens. You know, you believe in aliens more than I do.
You don't believe in aliens?
I don't really believe in aliens, no.
Are you out of your mind?
I mean, I don't deny that there's probably life in the universe, but I don't believe in flying saucers.
No, that's what aliens are. It's just...
one of your favorite movies is The Light in the Sky, right?
Fire in the Sky.
Fire in the Sky. And that's about alien abductions.
It's not about my favorite movie, but that is fucking terrifying movie. One of the movies that I'm watching it and I'm like, oh, this is not scary at all. I finish Ends, I'm in bed, and I'm just like, oh shit. You know, so I'm just kind of like, and I'm not saying that they are here. I mean, now that we're seeing now more and more like people from the Air Force and people saying that, yeah, we've seen things all the time. Like the government is actually saying more.
And I think this is propaganda. I think
and
that Trump started
what
this.
May, but where whatever, they, no, what, yeah. What I'm saying is that I'm not saying that I don't care if they are here or not. Probably not. I don't know. But the mere fact to deny it existing and outside our insignificant planet to this massive universe where we have billions and trillions and more than we can count stars, that those stars are like our sun, that they have planets and those planets might have life just like ours, just like something else, that can be bacteria and that still counts as an alien.
Right. I should be more clear there. I don't believe in saucers, alien abductions. I don't believe that any aliens have visited our planet. I don't think they're mutilating cows. I don't think they're alienly probing people. I don't believe in any of that stuff. We started this during the Trump administration. I think that the government is talking about aliens now to distract from other things. I think it's just propaganda.
It can be propaganda or not, but the thing is, like, it is one of those things that's like ghosts, right? Do they exist? Do they not exist?
I don't believe in them either, yeah.
And it's just one of those things that I never seen anything. I have never experienced any ghosts or aliens or stuff like that. The only thing that I might give them a very slight benefit of the doubt that probably the Air Force people might seen them, but at the same time, it's like, we are a young planet compared to the rest of the universe, and we are taking gigantic steps towards amazing technology. What, 60 years ago? That's when we finally made it to the moon, and now we're like, we haven't been outside of the moon, but they have like this amazing technology that now we can explore other galaxies and places, and it's just seen far, far away. And that's pretty amazing. So for me, the idea of like maybe somewhere in those other stars that might have a planet or might have some intelligent life, that maybe they have better technology than us because they are more advanced than us. I'm not saying it's impossible. It is possible. Now, I don't know if it's like possibility of them coming to Earth is like, yes, they're coming to Earth. I'm not saying that, but it might say like, no, that's absolutely cannot happen. Eh, I cannot say that either. When somebody I hear like, oh, it was abducted, or like the Fire in the Sky movie, I don't believe it, you know, but it's still terrifying because it can happen, you know, but I don't believe it.
So, and I prefer aliens as a symbol, you know, in the case of the alien xenomorphs from the movies, just this primal terror, this bestial force that's an absolute killing machine that's more powerful than us and more cunning that we underestimate and very much at our peril. And in the case of Martian Manhunter, the otherness, the perspective of the outsider, the perspective of the immigrant, that sort of thing. So I'm more interested in aliens as a theme or a symbol than I am as an actual concept. So I started doing Martian Manhunter blogging in the late 90s. I stopped for about 5 years, and then inspired by the Aquaman Shrine, I restarted it as a daily blog. Around 2010, I think we went to our first Comic Palooza. I'd never gotten commissions before. I'd gotten a few sketches from artists before, but I'd never actually gone to an artist and asked them to draw something specifically for me and paid them a set price for doing that. And so I learned about commissions at that, I believe it was the 2010 Comic Palooza, and I've been every year since. And one of my main things that I did was I had commissions of characters related to Martian Manhunter, because the character, his greater universe had so little exploration, and so much of the material that was in his solo stories had never been depicted by modern artists. I liked doing these pinups of Martian Manhunter related characters. But by 2016, I was starting to burn out on that, and I was looking for something new to do because I still enjoyed collecting art, I still enjoyed getting commissions, but I wasn't really interested in continuing the Martian Manhunter stuff. And so because it was the 30th anniversary of Aliens, and because our local convention, Houston's Comic Palooza, was going to be the first time to host the vast majority of the cast of the movie Aliens, I thought, well, wouldn't it be cool to get original artwork of the various actors in this movie and then take it to the actors and have them sign it. I'm not a person who typically goes for signatures, but to show them a piece of art representing them and interacting with the performer and discussing the art with the performer of them and of the characters they portrayed, that was an interesting angle to go at this particular project from. And again, it's the cast of one of my favorite movies actually coming to Houston. It, to me, it was a point of pride too that Houston was going to actually host this. And unfortunately, later that same summer, the San Diego Comic-Con scooped us by getting the director, James Cameron, who's never been to Houston by knowledge. They got the producer, Gail Ann Hurd, and then they got one of the actors, Lance Henriksen, who played Bishop, the synthetic being, who didn't make it to us until the following year. So what should have been a real crowning achievement for Houston ended up being
one of the many.
Sort of the trailer for San Diego Comic-Con, unfortunately. So that was a shame. But you were present for that gathering, so going to get the
I
artwork.
I have to say, so I never get artwork. So my main enjoyment on going to comic conventions with Frank is to actually see his excitement and trying to explain to the artist, trying to portray what he wants from the art. And me loving that passion, you know, I always want to be present on that. So I'm kind of like, I call myself the assistant. I know it can be derogatory because I'm a woman, but trust me, it's not. Because I don't get commission. He is actually traveling with like multiple backpacks and cases and stuff where he keeps his references, where he keeps like the blank sheets and all these things. So he's carrying a lot of things. And so he's talking to the artist and or the people who is going to make the drawing. So it might take a long time for him to start pulling out things, commissioning. So I'm kind of trying to facilitate that for him to focus just on the art piece.
And this was definitely the most money I've ever spent on a commission project overall. And definitely, without a doubt, the most money I've ever spent with the convention itself. Since I didn't just get the weekend pass like I would normally get, I'm also getting the speed pass. I'm prepaying for all of the signatures that I can in advance. So it was really to Comic Palooza's benefit to have an event like this. Other conventions do this. And unfortunately, possibly because of the San Diego scoop, they've not done it ever again.
What I Well, let me ask you this. So I know that you bought like the ultimate pass for Alien, right?
Mm-hmm.
I didn't get that.
Well,
pass.
Not everything, because I did not choose to get photographs with the
Okay,
actors.
Besides the photographs, like on the comic conventions, whenever they have like somebody really famous or a group of famous people, they have like this massive lines that they have to control people, how many and this and that. There are some lesser characters or actors that they don't get to have that because there's not that many people going to see them, but for mainly the main ones they do. So you did get the pass that it give you the almost the ultimate advantage of trying to get near the main actor.
Mm-hmm.
I did not get that pass. Why did I get that pass? I don't remember. Did it cost a lot of money or?
Yeah, it was pretty expensive.
Okay.
It was several hundred dollars to do.
So I did get the pass to go inside early, but I didn't get the VIP ultimate to trying to get inline advantage and stuff like that. Yeah. So, okay, continue.
Yeah. I was very excited to read the Space Marines comics finally. So as soon as I got my omnibus, I got started on it. And I was surprised at how much I was enjoying them, actually. One problem, though, is you don't want to try to read them all in one sitting, as I essentially did, because the repetitive nature of the stories becomes apparent very quickly. Rather than going through each individual story, I can basically tell you the story of the entire line. So what happens in every comic is that a group of Space Marines, no less than two, but usually more, land on an alien world to investigate an infestation. There always is one. Despite theoretically having an unlimited budget, since it's a comic book, the locations are almost always the sort of out-of-doors spots that a movie with no budget would use without having to get permits and such. It's always a field or a cave or a swamp, you know, things like that. So the two Space Marines are like, watch out for what's coming. And then it comes. Typically, one of them gets captured. It's taken off to be implanted. So the remaining Space Marine and whoever else they gather up to go with them go to rescue the other person. The Space Marine is liberated, but then a new form of alien that hadn't been seen before attacks. From there, either a new character, a new weapon, a new vehicle gets introduced, and they have to come up with a novel way to defeat the new alien that was just introduced. There is a fatalist quality to the Aliens franchise where you always get the sense of never being able to beat back this existential threat entirely. It's weird how that plays into a mini comic, because you watch a G.I. Joe cartoon or read a comic book, and even if they don't manage to completely quash the threat of Cobra, usually they have a definitive victory, and then there's a salute and a song, and you know, it always has an up ending. The Aliens comics tend to have etheric endings for the Space Marines, so after a while you sort of feel beaten down by it. These guys just never quite get a clear victory. There's always a leftover egg that they missed that attaches to some gorilla with an ook sound, which is ridiculous but fun. There's always some indication that the area that they're supposed to clear isn't, and there's a sense of them just not being very good at their jobs since they never managed to kill all the aliens, and you know they're always going to come back. Something that I think definitely sets apart the Kenner Aliens comics is that they are serialized. There are arcs. They're usually a couple or three books per arc, and again, they do essentially tell the same story over and over again, but it's weird that they're actually numbered so that you can understand the full sequence. So all 12 of the Alien Space Marines books are written by Dan Jolly, who would go on to do the Jason Rush Firestorm reboot. He had some creator-owned projects and did other work for Dark Horse. The first comic is titled Desert Storm. It's drawn by Norman Felchel and Mark McKenna. The spotlight character is Bishop, but of course, great liberties are taken. He in no way resembles Lance Henriksen. Actually, few of these characters look like the actors. I think there was often an issue with licensing rights, but I think a special effort was made to change Bishop because they were trying to do an amalgamation of several Jim Cameron characters. Most people mention him looking like RoboCop without his mask on, but with the sunglasses and the hand cannons. He also looks a lot like the Arnold Schwarzenegger Terminator. This isn't helped by the fact that the Bishop in the comic books is constantly analyzing. So like with the Terminator graphics that we see in the movies, he's basically telling you the sort of stuff that you would get in those graphics. I've analyzed this alien and this thing is clearly part scorpion, you know, that sort of thing. Or I calculated we've got this much ammunition, or we have this percentage of beating the back our foes or dying, yada yada. Because it's all done in dialogue, there's a quality of data to the character from Star Trek. And right from the first story, you're seeing where they're going to run into problems, because this is really hard PG-13 violence. The thing that keeps it from the R rating is that they don't show red blood. In fact, I don't think they ever show any of the humans shot, bleeding, cut, anything like that. A lot of the violence is done through, against humans, I should say, is done through implication. Like when you have an entire town get caught by the aliens, and you know what that means in the movies, but they don't explicitly say that these guys are being impregnated with chest bursters. You know that's happening, but they don't show it and they don't explicitly say it, and therefore it's apparently kid safe in that way. There's also a lot of alien blood spilled. There's a lot of gunfire. There's a lot of green acid splashing around. They don't shy away from brutally killing the aliens, and because they're aliens, I guess it's supposed to be okay. You definitely have images of violence, though. I think that you can only get so much cover out of it being applied to aliens. It's a very squishy, wet story. In this first tale, besides turning Bishop into a Terminator, they also give Apone a cybernetic arm that I think it's implied that he got from whatever incident happened on Acheron. So at the end of the first story, Bishop teams up with Hicks to go rescue Apone. That leads into number two, Operation Rescue. This one's drawn by Dennis Rodier, who I think is best known as an inker. I want to say he worked with guys like Kieron Dwyer on Superman titles, maybe Jackson Geiss as well. So where the first story looks very wannabe Image, you know, everything's outsized, big muscles, big guns. The second one is a little bit more staid, a little more moody. I think a better reflection of aliens in general, although not moody enough. It looks more like production stills of the Colonial Marines posing than it does the actual movie itself. So on this one, Apone gets freed. He gets to use his cybernetic arm to help rip down the tough goo that had trapped him. They have their first run-in with the Scorpion aliens, which ends that installment. Then we move into number three, Hive War.
All right, sweetheart, so what are you waiting for? Breakfast in bed? Another glorious day in the Corps. Day in the Marine Corps is like a day on the farm. Every meal's a banquet. Every paycheck a fortune. Every formation a parade. I love the Corps!
Oh, fall in, people. Come on, let's go.
Master Sergeant Al Apone was played by actor Al Matthews, one of the few leads that was not at either Houston's Comic-Palooza or at San Diego Comic-Con. He passed away a couple of years later in 2018. Apone is cover featured on this one. The interiors are drawn by Joe Phillips and John Dell. Joe Phillips also provided painted covers for the entire line of books. It gives it consistency, and it's good look. They're good looking covers, and they more or less feel appropriate to the aliens aesthetic. There are some exceptions. We'll touch on that. We're three books in before we introduce Ripley, and they make a point of noting that she uses a flamethrower as her primary weapon. Being that this is tied into a toy line, you're going to have that sort of thing happen, of course. Phillips is especially good at working within the format. He's able to get multiple panels onto the page and have it work and be dynamic. His layouts are definitely among the strongest of the artists working on the books. Apone uses these it looks like he's carrying a mace, but it's actually a sci-fi equivalent to the old grenades that the Nazis used in World War II, where they have the long handle and then the blocky canister where the explosives are, so you can really get a good toss on them. These are used to bring down a cave-in, trapping the aliens, and this is the first time we get to see the sense of, well, are the aliens still alive? When one of them reaches out from the rubble to claw his way back to the surface, then yeah, there's a good sense that they are.
They ain't paying us enough for this, man.
Not enough to have to wake up to your face, Drake.
What? Is that a joke?
Oh, wish it were.
Hey, Hicks. Man, you look just like I feel.
My understanding was that the Alias toy line sold well enough to, you know, they managed to get up to, I think, four or five series. But what they discovered as it went along was that the ones that were really selling were the aliens themselves, not the humans, the space marines. And to some degree, you see that reflected in the comic books, because roughly every other cover, actually probably more than that, is a alien spotlight cover to show off the new hybrid designs. And so when I don't mention the cover, it usually means that's one of the alien covers. So part four is Jungle Attack. This one's drawn by Tony Harris. Back before people knew who he was. It's a really nice looking installment. It doesn't look a lot like Tony Harris, though. It reminds me more of Brian Stelfreeze, who unfortunately didn't contribute to this project. But Harris had an interesting take on Bishop, to where he has vents on the sides of his face, but are still fleshy, so it's almost like gills. It's a lot cooler looking than anybody else draws this character. This one's also the start of a new arc. It's set in a jungle. This is where we get Drake finally. For some reason, he doesn't have a scar on his face, which I thought was one of the defining characteristics of the guy in the movie, but he does have the white hair, and he is supposed to be the master of the smart gun, so he's the only one of the space marines that has the distinctive smart gun from the movies. However, for some reason, he hardly uses it in the comics. He tends to use a pulse rifle, just like the majority of them. There's four-armed gorillas running around, and because of that, you end up with these gorilla aliens, which actually looks kind of cool. They have bigger arms than usual. Otherwise, not, you know, they're a bit bulky overall, but they're still clearly recognizable as regular xenomorphs. You've got some good action. Harris does tend to favor
favor the splash page. You also see a dismemberment of an alien, so it's another instance where, yeah, they were never going to get away with this in children's animation.
I usually get art commissions done at the local shows, and I decided to have drawings of each cast member done so I'd have something unique and personally gratifying to get signed, as well as to serve as a conversation piece. In the case of actor Mark Ralston, who played Private Mark Drake, I thought Vo Nguyen would be a good fit for Vasquez's hard man partner in crime, Drake. I was thinking we'd be doing multiple artist jam pieces at this point, but that didn't plan out, leaving a lot of negative space on some of these early pieces. This piece suffered during that shift, since the black squiggly lines radiating from Drake prevented any other characters from being organically integrated into the piece. But all the negative space left over made the piece look terribly plain compared to others' work. I felt bad about presenting it to the actor who played Drake, Mark Ralston, and got into my head to return to the jam concept for a background. Lance Scheibe had started a couple of jam pieces for me in the past, and was a real trooper at fleshing out this piece. Because of time constraints, I'd gone ahead and gotten Ralston's signature, and he was very gracious and warm during the process. I'd also handed out my reference materials, even the 1986 Starlog magazine I'd picked up that spotlighted aliens and included some pullout posters. I'd gone to the trouble of putting indexing tabs all over it, but the photos weren't great, and I mostly stuck with high-resolution internet printouts. Even still, neither was on hand for the artist, Lance Scheibe, so between whatever he could dig up on his phone and pure imagination, he crafted an appropriately grotesque, Geiger-esque, organic alien hive shell around Drake, with squirming maggots and draping tendons for good measure. He took the piece all the way home, and I'm grateful for him jazzing it up.
I had a very interesting audition. I just did a movie called Revolution with Al Pacino, which was an awful film. And got called in. I first met with Gail Ann Hurd, and Gail was like, "So, what have you been doing?" And I began to weave a tale of total fabrication and lie that I had the best role next to Al Pacino in this film. It was so convincing, I finally got called back to see Jim, but you know, sometimes lying works.
Issue number 5 is titled Meltdown. This one has a Drake highlight cover. It's an odd one because it's set in the jungle, but it's very bright outside. It's very sunny, very autumnal colors. The alien that is featured on the cover is heavily disguised, so the emphasis is on Drake with his smart gun, and just below that, his love gun. It's pretty hard to miss. They even give it a light shading highlight. The interiors on this one were by Rick Hoberg. Just inherently hilarious, I think, because up to this point, the alien comics still had a 90s quality to them, but all of a sudden you get to Hoberg, and this is a Bronze Age DC artist, best known for doing stuff like All-Star Squadron. It's like when Kurt Swan would draw a Master of the Universe story for DC Comics Presents for a team-up with Superman. It just seems extremely odd and out of place, but also super-duper toyetic. Like, this is the sort of thing that you would see done with these action figures. One of the best people you could get to try to make aliens feel like a G or PG property. It's very friendly and brightly colored and no mood whatsoever. And that's not a diss on Hoberg. I really enjoy his stuff. I got a commission from him, in fact. But it's so weirdly applied to a property like the aliens. And this one, Ripley gets kidnapped by one of the gorilla aliens. The macho men have to come and rescue her. This is one of the ones where they introduce a vehicle. So Bishop gets into one of the toy ships that happens to have this big glass container. Essentially, they're collecting the bug. And because they're low on ammo, they're going to pick up the bug in this water jug thing, fly it over an active volcano, and drop it in. Comics Alliance made a gag out of that a few years back.
I guess we're not going to be leaving now, right?
I'm sorry, Newt.
You don't have to be sorry. It wasn't your fault. We better get back, because it'll be dark soon, and they mostly come at night. Mostly.
As I usually do with commissions, I spent a fair amount of time researching the prospective artists to decide which characters best suited their individual styles. Matt Haley is one of my favorite comic artists, and one of the very few for whom I'll buy a comic just for their art alone. This would be my first chance to get a Haley, and he's especially good at drawing women, so it wasn't a hard decision to select him for the main subject, Ripley. When I approached Haley, he confessed to having a soft spot for Sigourney Weaver, and was enthusiastic about the piece. In fact, he was hired to draw her for comic book style interstitial scenes in the Walter Hill movie that was initially going to be called Tomboy, a Avengers tale, eventually released as The Assignment. But Haley had not gotten to meet Sigourney Weaver or find out whether she liked his portrayal of her. Star Michelle Rodriguez was more obviously approving, having gotten Haley to paint a portrait of her to keep. Haley really wanted to paint Weaver as well, and I suspect for however much he might have aimed to do good work for me, his efforts were at least partly driven to audition for Weaver, if I could get the piece into her hands. Again, I'd originally planned to do another multi-character artist jam along the lines of the John Jones family portrait, but Haley effortlessly talked me into allowing him to do a fully ink rendering pairing of both Ripley and Newt that would extend to a take-home project and a FedEx shipment ahead of Comicpalooza and the arrival of the Aliens cast to Houston. Obviously, Haley was a man of his word, producing an excellent cover-quality piece that puts most of Dark Horse's published efforts to shame, complete with a background and a cameo appearance from an alien warrior. The likenesses are solid and the personalities are dead on. Now, the pieces of Ripley and Newt, but I especially love the touch of adding Casey, the plastic doll head that was Newt's only toy and companion after the massacre of her family at Hadley's Hope. Virtually every square inch of Interspace was utilized, so when I brought it to Carrie Henn, the actress who played Rebecca Newt Jordan, I asked her to sign the back. She was, I think, the first autograph I collected, and helped start the pattern of the actors adding the character name below their signature in quotation marks. She was nice and seemed to like the piece. Plus, I got a certificate of authenticity with her picture and a little hologram sticker on it.
Well, to be honest with you, once the movie came out, I like really had no concept of how big Aliens was until about 7 or 8 years ago. And so now it's kind of cool. And it's fun to go and see stars, but it's a very surreal experience because I'm a teacher, you know, and I used to... understand this part of my life, so it's kind of nice because my husband and children get to be a small part of it and see a little bit of me that it's hard for everyday people that I hang out with to really understand. I had a different take on the death scenes. I actually hated them because it meant each time there was one, someone else left. And Sporty and I used to kind of joke and say that we were like the orphans that nobody wanted because everyone was leaving and we were like still there. It was sad just because they were all leaving.
Happy? You made her upset.
That was on Friday. The next day was Saturday, and the only chance to get Sigourney Weaver to sign for her character, Ellen Ripley.
So, of course, the priority was going to be Sigourney Weaver, because where some of these actors have appeared in various shows, she's the star. She's still a star. She's maybe not as big as she once was, but she doesn't have to do conventions. She doesn't do a lot of conventions. This was a special thing that she did this one year. I'm not aware of her doing other conventions besides. And so, of course, she was going to have the biggest lines. That particular year, there were two actors who had huge lines, were Serpentine, Velvet Ropes, and everything else. It was Kate Beckinsale from the Underworld movies and a bunch of other stuff, and Sigourney Weaver. And so she was the priority. She was the first one I had to go get.
We made a beeline for Weaver's section, despite it being a bit of a crapshoot, since she was only scheduled to sign for 1 hour before the Aliens panel, and then two more afterward, plus some photo ops somewhere in there.
And you have a bit of a story with that.
Yeah. So we go inside early because of the early passes. And of course, we are like going really, really fast, trying to get in a good position in line. We're carrying the artwork. We're carrying everything that we always carry on every convention, separated into Frank and myself. And I'm standing there in line as well because it's like, hey, I would like to see this person. And especially because I seen Frank actually getting the art piece about her, for which is really, really, really nice. And so it is nice to actually be there present when he gets that piece signed. So we were in line for quite a while. Like it was like 30-45 minutes, but of course it was like a lot of confusion because you have different type of passes.
Comicpalooza hadn't tried to host something this elaborate before, and it seemed like they were struggling with managing it as well.
Yeah, so it was a lot of confusion because some people had, like, let's just say for the sake of argument free, because I don't remember the actual names, like they have the gold pass and the silver and the copper, right? So I think I was like in the silver or the
something
copper.
Like that. Yeah,
and Frank was like with
platinum.
The gold, like yes, like the ultimate. So there was like, we were still within the good line size, not too far away, but not too close. But of course, you only have limited time because these people, they only have limited time for signing because they have to set aside for photos and panels and all that. So, you know, if you don't get her at the time before she goes through the photos and the panels, then you might be stalking in line for hours because to get out of the line and stuff. So it was like trying to get closer. So it was a lot of confusion, but like, I have a platinum pass, but blah, 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 yeah. No.
And there was one guy, I don't remember if he was in front of us or behind us, but he was extremely emotional about it.
Oh, yes.
Very performatively emotional.
When she actually comes out the first time, the guy screams and shrieks and almost falls into the floor.
He cried,
like,
right?
Yeah, he cried. I'm like, oh my God. I was just like amazed and a little bit scared of this kid that he was going to have like a I don't know, like a panic attack in there, So yeah, he was very, very emotional. So yeah, so we were there in line. It was very exciting because we were not too far, but not too close. And we're carrying everything. And I'm getting really, really excited because I'm going to see Frank actually getting signed and talking to her. He actually likes her a lot. So I was getting like that excitement bubbling inside me, not like the crazy guy in front of us, but I was getting pretty excited. And then out of the blue, they like somebody says, like, everybody with platinum passes, move this way, you know, like a faster line. And I heard that person say that, and the only thing I remember is like me turning to tell Frank about it, but at that time he was already gone. Not even like if he said like, see ya, that was like in my brain just seeing like him maybe hoping in the deep of my heart him saying like, oh, I'll see you later, or nothing. Like literally I just turned to tell him he was gone.
It was like a cartoon where there's nothing left but like a whiff of smoke.
And he didn't even tell me anything like, I'll be back or this and that. No, he was gone.
In my defense, a woman had come up telling people about the VIP pass line beforehand. And so I thought that she had seen me walk off with this woman to join the VIP line. But apparently she was probably watching the overdramatic person and then turns around and I'm already gone. Because I'm assuming she's seen me go and clearly that hadn't happened.
Yeah,
and so I get my express pass.
Well, I am standing there in line and I'm just like, okay, well, Frank is gone and he's gone to a better and bigger things, you know? And we were like, that was like, what, like 5-6 years within that. So it was already like, yeah, he's going to come back tonight anyway. So anyhow, so I'm like standing there in line with half of his items and I see him over there like being all excited, almost close to the guy that was in front of us. But nah, I'm just kidding.
I didn't realize that as part of my specific admission package, I got to leapfrog over a lot of angry people who thought they were already in the maximum speed line. I felt more than a little guilty bypassing them, but I also wanted to get this key autograph out of the way. On the plus side, I was through her line with a signed commission by a half hour into the regular floor hours, giving me clear sailing for my next time-sensitive autographs. On the downside, I didn't get any companion certificate, Weaver was doing no personalizations, and her handlers were only allowing about 10 to 15 seconds of FaceTime with the actress. I used this very narrow window to tell her about how the piece she was signing was by the guy who did the interstitials on the movie she just did, and how he'd love to paint her someday, and I literally took more time saying this sentence than I was allotted to speak to her coherently. I did my best to deliver that message for Matt Haley, though, so I can take a measure of pride in coming through even to that marginal degree.
No, he was getting like there very, very excited because he was very close to her, and I'm just standing there in line, and then I feel it's like, what am I in the world I'm doing here? What, am I just gonna ask her to sign like a napkin or something, and it's gonna take forever to do that? So I just literally get out of the line, and when I did that, people start looking at me like I was crazy. It's like, why are you leaving? We're like closer. Why are you leaving? And I'm just like, I don't care anymore. So I was able to see Frank getting the autograph and talking to her for like 20 feet apart, where I can imagine him making the happy face because I couldn't be able to see it.
Hey, Mira, who's Snow White?
She's supposed to be some kind of consultant. Apparently, she saw an alien once.
Whoopie fucking do. Hey, I'm impressed.
Give me this.
So number 6 is Showdown. This one's by Brandon McKinney and Carl Kessel. I'm not familiar with this artist. This one has a Hicks spotlight, but I think of all the characters, perhaps Hicks is the most altered for this. Again, Hicks would have been the obvious male lead for this toy line, but instead they make him the tech guy, which was more of Hudson's thing in the movie. And the dialogue for the character is just atrocious because he's constantly talking in nerd computer terms. Instead of game over, man, he's like, bad info. What? And so by this time, the cast expanded to have Ripley, Drake, Apone, Bishop, Hicks, and they're all in this Old West frontier town where they're confronted with a stampede of bull aliens. And if it sounds like we're getting into cornball territory and the initial fizzy response to the comics is starting to abate and fizzle out. Yeah. Yeah, exactly that. It doesn't help that this artist is trying to do a standard comic book, multi-panels, and it's just not working. It just bogs down the flow of the story and everything is just too small.
How long after we're declared overdue can we expect a rescue?
17 days.
17 days?
Hey, man, I don't want to rain on your parade. We're not going to last 17 hours. Those things are going to come in here just like they did before, and they're going to come in here, and they're going to come in here, and they're going to get us.
This little girl survived longer than that with no weapons and no training. Right?
Why don't you put her in charge?
You better just start dealing with it, Hudson. Listen to me. Hudson, just deal with it because we need you and I'm sick of your bullshit.
Bill Paxton is one of my favorite Aliens cast members, both because of his willingness to put himself out there with difficult characters and because he's such a Texan. I know the characters he plays in real life and sometimes I see myself in them. My cousin is basically Hudson plus Vince Vaughn's character from Maid. It's also why I love Billy Bob Thornton's screenplays, especially One False Move, which starred Paxton as an overeager small-town sheriff in way over his head as vicious murderers bring neo-noir to town on their way to Houston. I can't imagine how hard it is to play a cowardly blowhard like Hudson, or a human hurricane like Dale Dixon, or the dichotomy of a God-fearing serial killer like the father in Frailty. It has to be emotionally draining and often thankless, because Paxton so inhabits these compromised characters that he doesn't get the credit for his acting effort. I feel that Hudson is one of the iconic roles in cinema, like Ripley, Vasquez, and Burke, that created an archetype seen in scores of flicks since. I also believe Bill Paxton remains one of the great under-recognized character actors, so I wanted to get a really awesome commission to show my appreciation for both the character and performer. I wanted someone who could capture Hudson's more comedic style, but wouldn't drift too far outside the action, horror, sci-fi of the films, as reflected by the other commissions. Ahead of the show, I seriously considered Joseph Michael Lindsner, but he canceled soon after he was announced. For 2 days, I traveled up and down Artist Alley, trying to find a replacement that can manage the precarious balance required to nail Hudson. After much deliberation, I finally chose Jeff Shaw, an up-and-coming artist I'd been impressed by through his online galleries, and I'd just gotten a copy of his Dark Horse comic book, The Paybacks, but I hadn't had a chance to read it yet. We set up the commission late on Saturday, and he wasn't able to get it done Sunday, so we made arrangements for me to pick it up from his hotel lobby the next day, shortly before he was to leave for his flight, which at the time was seeming to become a habit after picking up jobs from Rob Liefeld and Norm Ratman the same way. I seriously had no idea what to expect when I showed up, which was great, because I got to be that much more blown away by the reveal of the finished work. I'd asked Jeff Shaw to take the character seriously, treating with respect a braggart in an unbelievably terrifying situation who cracks under the strain but still soldiers on, not remotely in those words, but in a scatterbrained approximation with a bunch of other babbling nonsense to muddle through. As Shaw put it, he's not a strong man, but he's sincerely looked into the soul of Hudson and found at least a semblance of strength in a man who watches everything he had faith in collapse swiftly and brutally under the weight of xenomorph infestation. It's an exceptional likeness, but more than that, Shaw captures the very being of Paxton as Hudson. I was overwhelmed with admiration for the obvious effort, and when I showed the piece to other artists, they were very impressed with the technique, which presumably included cutting out a stencil around the main figure to allow him to be dirtied up with greasy ink splotches in the midst of shuttle wreckage, while surrounding backgrounds remained pristine. Surely a time-intensive but highly satisfying effect. This gorgeous commission immediately rocketed up to my favorites. A few weeks later, I hopped into Bill Paxton's signature line at Comicpalooza. And then my recollection is that from there you went into the Bill Paxton line, didn't you? Was he like the second guy?
Yes, because you did have a list of who do we need to approach at what time, like, you know, after who, because
yeah, especially I think they had schedules, but I also had different people that I had prioritized.
Yes, because there is like people who you knew that it was going to be Lars. Oh, yeah, I think that's what I did afterwards because I knew the schedule so well.
Yeah, I think you just moved on and took up a space in line to the next person. And so as I'm walking around with my signed piece, you start calling to me to join you in your point in that particular line.
Yes, because instead, yes, I do remember that because it's like, why am I doing in this line where he already got in his signature? I can actually move on into the next one because if people were going to move out from her to this older guy, it was going to be more people whenever he got out. So I actually went to make line on the other guy.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And so I believe that Bill Paxton was next.
Yes.
Who, of course, portrays Private William Hudson.
I think that's how I was there with you on that one. I was with you pretty much on all of them.
I think the only one that we were separated on was Weaver because it was such a
separated?
Big line. Yeah. That's you were abandoned. Like, the only one I had to abandon you on. Yes.
That is a very good piece too.
Yeah. I thought that was extraordinary.
He's the one with the say, game over, man. Game over.
Well, so we get to him in line and one thing that's interesting with Bill Paxton, besides the fact that he was just one of my favorite character actors, and of course he's one of the most dynamic presences in one of my favorite movies, but it also doesn't hurt that both my cousin and I have been told that we had a slight resemblance to Bill Paxton and how we speak and somewhat in general appearance. I think in terms of actual physical appearance, my cousin looks more like him, but we both at various points have talked somewhat like him. He met with a big smile and a boisterous voice, jubilantly scrutinizing the piece and pointing
pointing out his wife's name on Hudson's armor. I explained how this was an original piece of art, the overall project, and also how much I'd enjoyed Paxton's overall career, seeing his directorial offering Frailty with Friends during its theatrical run. I might have even referenced his old band Martini Ranch, as suggested by their fan, Matt Haley. I'd only asked Paxton to carry on the character name theme from the other actor's signatures, but after my fanboy gushing, Paxton said, "All right, you're getting a game over, man." I don't know if that was some sort of prize, but I certainly dug it. And I think Paxton genuinely did too.
While there were a bunch of people in that line who I think loved Bill Paxton and told him how awesome he was and told him how much they loved him in stuff like Terminator or Titanic, because he's in a lot of Jim Cameron movies, for me coming up to him and talking about his musical, I think he got extra excited for that. He was just so happy, so enthused. He loved the piece. He was very excited about it. It was great to meet him. His enthusiasm was infectious. And especially because he passed away not long after that, I'm so grateful that I had the opportunity to meet him and share that moment with him while he was still with us, you know, and to tell him how much I appreciated his work while I had the chance. You don't think about how these people are going to die on you. He's maybe 20 years older than me or so, or was at the time. Now he's gone. It's good to take advantage of those opportunities when they present themselves.
Just like me with Ricky Vasquez?
Yes, just like you with Ricky Vasquez from...
My So-Called Life.
Yeah. Number 7 is Stampede. This one's drawn by William Knapp and Robert Campanella. Again, not familiar with them. The action is taking place in a big grassy field, which doesn't really sell the scares. Apparently, the bull aliens are particularly susceptible to heat, so that gives Ripley something to do. And this is also one of your more definitive victories for the group. There's actually a big group shot of everybody at the end of that particular story.
Hey, I want to introduce you to a personal friend of mine. This is an M41A pulse rifle. 10 millimeter, then over and under 30 millimeter pump action grenade launcher. Feel the weight.
Okay, what do I do?
Pull it inside here.
Right.
Uh-huh. Lean into it.
Mm-hmm.
All right, now we'll kick some. When the counter reads zero here, you...
I press this up?
That's right. All right, get another one in quick. Slap it in hard.
Right.
You're ready to rock and roll.
What's this?
That's a grenade launcher. I don't think you want to mess with that.
You started this. Show me everything. I can handle myself.
Yeah, I noticed.
Hicks was a tricky character because I'd planned to have him in a jam with Ripley and Newt, and drawn by either Eddie Barrows, who canceled out of the show at the last minute, or Aaron Lopresti, whose commission list filled up, so he turned me down. Now I needed a new artist who could deliver a more expansive single-character image for Hicks. I hadn't worked with Tommy Wynn before, but I liked his art samples, and his style seemed to suit Hicks, so I took a chance. Wynn did a great job on the character, his armor, his on-model pulse rifle, and placing him in a smoldering battlefield atop a mound of alien corpses. Badass. I brought the piece to Kyle Reese himself, who was pleasant. He had an oddly mechanical but metal signature of large intersecting straight lines and made an interesting showing at the Aliens cast panel.
I was flipping through the channels and looking for something to watch about 6 months ago. And it is the part where a shell is being opened and they find you at the very beginning of the movie and thing falls in, and I started watching it, and I just ended up watching the whole thing. And the movie is so special. We all, I think, all felt, everybody that worked on the movie felt like it had a chance to be really good. I don't think anybody expected to be 35 years later sitting here talking about it, But when I watch the movie and I kind of like was analyzing it, I get so many children. I mean, they're 8 and 10 years old and 12 years old. You know, parents love to watch the movies. And girls come up to me, they're like, oh, I love you, kids, I love you. I'll say, kids, what's your favorite movie? Captain America, Aliens. Aliens is my favorite movie. I realized when I watched the movie that I really hadn't thought about before was why people like the character of Hicks so much goes back to James Cameron. And if you watch Hicks in the movie, he's always smiling. You know, he's impressed, and he is surprised, I think. Crushing, kind of. I think that was so cool about that character that I was able to kind of give it up to you. And everything was like, that made Hicks cool was the fact that I respected you and that what you, that I knew that you knew what was going on and nobody else did. And so it's not the shooting, and it's not like, oh, great scenes, or aliens will come out, and we'll shoot, and all that. He's not a tough guy, you know? It was that little relationship. And by the way, that was written into the script by Jim Cameron. I don't get a chance to play that leading man character very often. I was very pleased with that kind of, I always call it a light story, you know? And I was very pleased with the light story. And I realized that as I watched the movie, why people like it so much, especially me.
A new one begins with number 8, Fireball, which features Ripley on the cover. I wanted to use the Ripley piece as the cover art for the podcast, but it just wasn't that strong of an image. But it does showcase the weird design choices made with Ripley 2. Again, they don't have licensing rights, so they tend to show her as though she has black hair instead of brown. And it's kind of more spiky, kind of more of an Annette Bening sort of thing. To make her work better for the toys, they give her like a bandana around her neck and a red shirt. And sometimes they show her with like bright yellow accessories and such. They're definitely trying to show the cartoon version of her here. But being that it's Ripley, they thankfully got probably the best artist available to the project, Dave Johnson. Love his work. Got a commission from him as well. This is also the one that's almost like a greatest hits compilation for Aliens because they're back in a place not dissimilar from LV-426. They're in the same type of corridors. They're in the same type of alien hive scenarios. They've got Ripley in a power loader fighting an alien queen. Johnson does get overly ambitious with 3 panel pages. It really bogs it down a bit. His art looks better when he's got the full splash page, but it still looks really good and it stands apart from the rest of the guys. The story even ends with a scowling Ripley giving you her best. Get away from her, you bitch.
I'm Burke. I'm Carter Burke. I work for the company, but don't let that fool you. I'm really an okay guy.
I'm glad to see you feeling a little better.
They tell me that all the weakness and disorientation should pass soon. It's just natural side effects of such an unusually long hypersleep or something like that.
What do you mean? How long was I out there?
Has no one discussed this with you yet?
No, but I mean, I don't recognize this place.
No, I know. Okay. It's just that this might be a shock to you. It's long.
How long, please?
57 years.
I don't have any recollection of, except for the guy Paul
Reiser. Because Ripley was obviously the most important character to get a commission of, she came first. My second stop was to Dietrich Smith, who had already contributed to 2 of my jam projects. I knew he could handle that kind of collaboration, plus he was good at likenesses, and I wanted someone with a more delicate touch handling Weasley corporate man Carter Burke amidst all those rugged colonial marines. I decided to flip the orientation to vertical to allow for fewer but larger figures, since the project was going to go across multiple boards anyway, and that would allow for a better modulation organization for the project. Smith put a lot of subtle variations in shading and pinstripe detail into the piece that unfortunately don't come across in the scan.
Good morning, Marines. I'm sorry we didn't have time to brief you people before we left Gateway, but...
Sir?
What's the question?
Is this going to be a stand-up fight, sir, or another bug hunt?
All we know is that there's still no contact with the colony and that a xenomorph may be involved. Anyway, we have it on disc, so you better look at it.
All right. Now listen up. I want this thing to go smooth and by the numbers.
I want DCS and tactical database assimilation by 0830. Ordnance loading, weapon strip, and dropship prep details will have 7 hours. Now move it, people!
Joe Rubenstein was one of the few marquee inkers in comics when I was growing up, thanks to his work on the official handbook of the Marvel Universe and the original Wolverine miniseries. He'd been to town once or twice before in recent years, but I always had in mind to get him to embellish one of my pencil-only commissions, but never got my stuff together to give it a go. Rubenstein's faces have a quiet nobility to them, and when I was considering artists to render Lieutenant Gorman, he seemed like a perfect fit. On the surface, Gorman was a handsome, stable, commanding officer for the Colonial Marines. It was only after his inexperience came to light and the fit hit the shan that Gorman was revealed to be a less-than-ideal candidate. After getting Dietrich Smith's Carter Burke back, I thought Gorman could contrast the softness of the murderously ambitious villain with a firmer line and appearance of strength, even though we would know that neither of these dudes were safe bets in the foxhole. It was great to finally meet Rubenstein. Even though he seemed a bit wary of the potentially negative association, "Why did you think of me to draw Gorman?" he asked. I assured him that it was solely because the quality of his work seemed capable of making this cowardly dude come across as admirable. I think he nailed the likeness, more so in facial shading that was lost in the scanning process, unfortunately. And when I presented the pieces to the actor who played Gorman, he seemed to dig it. William Hope was also gracious and acquitted himself well in the cast panel later in the weekend. So don't assume the fellow has anything in common with Gorman beyond an IMDb credit.
Stanley Kubrick, as far as I was concerned, was God. And surely you didn't get a contract finish date. Could have gone on for 2 years. He was still be there. And he was going to pay everybody across the board, apart from Matthew Modine, who was, you know, going to get paid a bit more. But then my agent brings me up before I sign this contract and says, they want to see you for a science fiction movie. And I said, yeah, Sally, do I want to, you know, do a science fiction movie? I'm working for Stanley Kubrick. And he said, no, it's a good script. It's just go along and see him. And I almost didn't want to do it. I said, yeah, okay. But I've been doing a play at the time, doing quite a lot of theater, Private Wars by Jim McClure, about veterans, Vietnam veterans. And so I was shaved and pumped and armied up. I went in to meet Jim and Gail at 20th Century Fox, and we were talking and chatting and said, right, okay, here's a script, give me Hudson's lines. So I got down to the lobby with the script in my hand, going to go and sit in Soho Park and learn it and come back and see them in 2 hours. And just as I'm going out the door, the receptionist, no, sorry, Mr. Hope, come back. We've been sent, give me those. I want you to look at this instead, Gorman. So I go by and I look at the script for like a couple of hours, come back at 3 o'clock, so I came back, and I just remember Gail and Jim bickering. I mean, Jim going, I'm shooting this audition, do you want to shoot it? You're going to tell me how to do this? Back and forth. So I didn't know who these guys were, and I hadn't seen Terminator there, but they were, you know, personal. And I think actually what got me the job, because I auditioned, and they said, so what are you doing now? I said, well, I'm about to go make a movie with Stanley Kubrick. Jim fell off his chair. He told me that as a physics student, before he went to Roger Corman, he saw 2001 Space Odyssey, and that moment changed his life. He thought, right, this is, I'm making movies, to hell with physics. And so I think Kubrick was a, you know, huge, huge hero, an inspiration to Jim. So 2 days later, the casting director rings up Mary Selway, lovely lady, bless her, not with us any longer. Ryan said, you are not going to leave this. Jim wants to offer a leading role to William, which is like 2 days after I met them. I was a little blasé. I hadn't seen the script yet. The script arrived, and I read it, and I just could not believe it. I mean, talk about it. I finished the script on the John at 4 o'clock in the morning because I couldn't put it down. I thought, I got to go to the John. I thought, no, I can't stop. And I finished it. The back, sitting on the John, I couldn't move. The script was unputdown.
Of the Aliens cast, I feel the greatest kinship with Bill Paxton and Paul Reiser, unlikely pop cult avatars, and I follow their careers the most closely. So many movies have tried to have their own Carter Burke, but it never works as well because they forget that he was more than a corporate slimeball with a homicidal eye toward the bottom line. Despite being manipulative and having an agenda, Carter Burke seemed like an alright guy that supported Ripley emotionally and in the xenomorph business for the better part of half of Aliens, especially if you factor in the revelations of the director's cut, before his true nature was revealed. You liked the guy,
so the betrayal stung all the more. Those positive qualities led me to Reiser's other contemporaneous movie roles, his stand-up, but most especially one of my all-time favorite TV shows, Mad About You. I relate strongly to Paul Buckman and appreciate his family and environment. That was one of the only long-running shows to end on a high note, and I made a point of telling Reiser so. Carter Burke was the second commission that I initiated. Given my affection for Reiser, I began to fret that he might take offense at having to share space with other characters when so many of the active fighters in the movie got their own solo works. I'd nixed the idea of adding another character like Spunkmeyer or an alien egg to fill out the page, but the intersect between that character and Burke was close lab encounters with a facehugger, which inspired the idea to use one of those to complete this jam. Facehuggers are one of the most memorable and unnerving aspects of the Alien franchise. With a live specimen that tried to kiss Burke with his prehensile sphincter stalk from inside a fluid-filled tank, anticipating his fate. I love this piece offering a chance to literally showcase the creature, especially as rendered by Cody Scheibe, who is excellent at depicting the weird and grotesque, as well as being another of my very favorite regular artists to commission. I was asking an awful lot of him, though, between the complicated organic spider crab beastie, the textures of the metal and the glass case, and his stroke rider's ego just a tad more, his mirror reflection, as reinterpreted by Scheibe in direct contrast to an entirely different artist on the same page. It was a ridiculous demand that I figured Scheibe would overlook to preserve his sanity, but instead he gave me every single thing I wanted with panache like the boss he is. Sigourney Weaver and Bill Paxton were the top priority signatures since they were only appearing for one day across less than 4 total hours between them over roughly simultaneous sittings broken in two between the cast panel. I don't remember if I had Scheibe's addition to the jam piece in hand yet, but with all the anxiety and hullabaloo from those first two signings, I wanted to take a break and check out pieces floating around Artist's Alley. Also, with Reiser scheduled to be signing for the rest of the weekend, I had hoped to eventually catch him during a dry spell and maybe try to milk some extra anecdotes out of him in a BS session. However, my girlfriend had kept her eye on Reiser and didn't think he was enjoying his time stuck at a comic convention in Houston in the summer. To my knowledge, besides Comicpalooza and SDCC, I don't think Reiser really does nerdy conventions. At her urging, I figured I'd go ahead and get the signature just in case, plus standing in line gave me more of an opportunity to mill about near the celebrities, eavesdropping without being creepy. But I've also enjoyed him in a lot of other movies. Just recently, I was rewatching Beverly Hills Cop, and I forgot that he was the reluctant partner, middleman, whatever, for Eddie Murphy's character in the police captain. He's been in tons of movies. I enjoy his humor, so I take the jam up to him. He didn't seem to be particularly enthused about anything.
He was very dismissive of everything. You know, maybe he was like, I don't want to be here. Frank was trying to not engage him too much in the conversation, but to just
see, he wasn't talking to anybody.
Thing, yeah. And he would just have that face kind of like, yeah, whatever. Yeah, I know. I am amazing. I'm cool.
I don't know if I quite go there.
That's what I took it. I did not like, see, I used to like this guy, but ever since then, that attitude is like.
I think it's important to understand that your interaction with fans is not common, and it's going to mean a lot more to them than it is to you, and to recognize that so that you don't diminish the fandom. I'm over it at this point because I still enjoy the body of work.
Yeah, I'm over him too. I don't care, but it's just at that point. Yeah. Because mainly it bothers me because you were really excited to go meet him.
Yeah.
And you did try. You were not annoying. You were not an asshole. You were not like, oh my God, you're so amazing. You know, like very like that. You were, hey, you know, I like you in this. We watched Mad About You and everything. And he was just like looking around and he's like, For which to me is like, dude, he's talking to you. You know, don't be such an ass.
My perspective, because I got a similar vibe off of John Cusack too, when we got stuff signed from him, and he's another actor that I'm very fond of. When you look at somebody like Sigourney Weaver, she was still getting the star treatment relative to this whole affair. And with someone like Paul Reiser, he's not getting treated the same way that Sigourney Weaver is, and he's perhaps not a people person, perhaps not one for these public spectacles.
But he wasn't pulling any people either.
And he wasn't out a lot either. You had to kind of watch him for when he was supposed to be out so you can go and get your stuff signed. He'd only be out for as long as there were people there, and then he went back and hit again. But I don't know, there's social anxiety issues potentially. There's, you know, disappointment that, you know, your career.
I have social anxiety, yeah. And I don't behave like an asshole.
But you get to, you're like, let's face it, you're in this big auditorium. You're coming up from behind a curtain. You're sitting in an uncomfortable chair. Random people are coming up to you and telling you you were great as that asshole in that one movie. It's not necessarily everybody's scene. So I try not to take it personally. I wasn't thrilled at the time, but I was an apologist then as well.
conventions just aren't for everybody. And especially with something like this, where you agree to this big 30th anniversary get together and you're looking forward to doing the panels, because he was much more lively in the panel and he was much more conversive at the panels, but it just may not be up to sitting at a table and having a bunch of randos come up to him and throw paper in his face and stuff. He may not have liked the drawing either, but the truth is, I think that he was not particularly enthused with anything related to that convention, so I just don't take that personally. When my turn came up, I presented the commission to Reiser, who said, "Hey, look, it's me with Bill Hope." I chatted with him a bit. He politely thanked me for my kind words, and that was it. I saw him again at the panel where he and Paxton stole a show with their lousy one question apiece in a shrimpy 40-minute Q&A involving 11 actors. I didn't see him again for the rest of the show, so I'm mighty damn glad I got to him when I did.
Aliens, in your body of work, where does it fall for you?
It's a phenomenal body. Let's just take a moment and because you brushed right past you. What would you do? It was, you know, it's very, very rare that you read a script and you know there's not going to be good. And I remember reading this script, and not only was it, I think it was going to be a hit, but it was actually exhilarating to read. I remember, like, every 12 pages, I have to, this is getting a little intense. I have to walk around the living room. So it's rare, you know, to be included in something that you know is going to be good. And I remember just thinking, if I just don't screw up my little part, this is going to work. So that was my goal. I had a very low bar for myself. Don't screw up the part that you're in.
Yeah.
How did you feel about playing the villain?
Well, again, you say villain.
More the villain, you know.
I suppose from your point of view, sure. But I know those back at the office were very pleased with my performance. Depends on what type of history you're on.
Number 9 is Night Strike. This one's drawn by John Nadeau and Steve Moncuse. And after the Dave Johnson, it's a real harsh come down. For starters, I guess somebody got a plot point mixed up. They seem to be back in the field from the Stampede one, rather than being, you know, in the cool, very aliens environment that Dave Johnson had done. Or maybe Dave Johnson went off script. I don't care if he did. It looked good. But they have to be in a field because a ship comes down to save them after they're surrounded by a bunch of aliens, piloted by the first new character introduced, Attax, who is very much the Poochie of the alien space marines. He's got a light brown flat top with a white streak through it, plus he got Drake's scar. He's wearing an alien armor. Essentially, he puts on armor to appear to be an alien queen and manages to fool the aliens. I thought one of the big plot points in Aliens was how smart these creatures were versus the assumption that they were more like simple animals, but apparently you can fabricate an alien queen armor and just walk around amongst them. After showing up the other space marines, Attax gets carried away by a new flying queen. It's later revealed that she was actually trying to protect her buddy as opposed to run off with one of the space marines.
Aliens!
No, Hicks! Something big is in the air!
It's the alien flying queen! And her gruesome gorillas! Send in the ultimate space marine, Attax, disguised in his big, bad bug suit!
He sneaks in and takes him out!
But the flying queen unmasks him! Send in Hicks and the heavily armored evac fighter!
Send in the marines!
Blast them!
Yeah!
And bottle them! And it's bye-bye bug, each sold separately.
Aliens!
As Comic Palooza approached, I began to realize that the convention had booked a number of non-actors associated with the aliens for the show. It occurred to me that I ought to get some sort of catch-all technical achievement commission that would create a space for all of these creators to be acknowledged and leave their John Hancocks. For instance, the entire team responsible for the first Dark Horse Comics Aliens miniseries was present, including illustrator Mark A. Nelson. I was familiar with him through his extensive work at Dark Horse, as well as the cool but forgotten Vertigo miniseries Blood and Shadows, with Tex and Joe R. Lansdale. I approached him about doing an alien queen, which he confessed he hadn't drawn in a long time, but we had a shared reference point through Starlog's 1986, the official Aliens movie book. He used it for years, but had only recently bought one after being taunted by ads for it, going back to my impoverished childhood. Nelson was totally game for the commission, and also a great sport in general, and a good conversationalist besides. I ended up buying a copy of Aliens 30th Anniversary, the original comic series from him, which is a very nifty, oversized hardcover collection of the first mini, covers, plates, anthology stories, and other rarities with black metallic ink ringing around the edges of the pages. Nelson drew an alien warrior head for me on the inside, while letterer Willie Schubert and writer Mark Verhaeven also signed the book and commission. Pretty sweet, no? They were joined on the art piece by Spat Octon of Spat Cave Studios, who designed costumes for the Aliens Colonial Marines video game and outfitted a number of cosplayers at the show, as well as Alec Gillis. The latter had done design and effects work on several Aliens films and is a feature on the commentary track for Alien 3. We had quite a nice chat about the virtues of practical effects and his then-current project, Annabelle Annabelle 2, which never would have happened without this commission.
Move it, Spunkmeyer. We're rolling.
Hold on a second. There's something.
Just get up here.
I'm in. Ramp closing.
Spunkmeyer was a character I didn't quite know what to do with. I thought about adding him to one of the more open Colonial Marine art jams, but he never saw that kind of direct action in the movie. I wouldn't put him in a cockpit scene with Corporal Farrow without knowing if I'd ever get to meet Colette Hiller for her autograph. She wasn't at the show, and I don't think she made it to San Diego either, now to think about it. Spunkmeyer was the other person besides Ripley seen using a power loader, but replacing her seemed sacrilegious, and the few artists I spoke with didn't seem keen on drawing that kind of equipment. I considered putting him in with Burke and Gorman as one of the sort of non-combatants, but I felt like it would be too crowded, and I didn't have great reference for his lower half. I then started thinking about obscuring it with something like a xenomorph egg, maybe even having Spunkmeyer squatting to lift a stream of alien ooze off it to reflect his climactic appearance in the bay of the dropship. I couldn't make up my mind. Space City Comic Con passed in a Comic Palooza, and I was swiftly running out of time. My girlfriend and I walked Artist Alley, going booth to booth, trying to figure out who to choose for this piece. Eventually, we reached Toni Shelton toward the end of our trek, and we were both impressed with her, so she received the nod. It turned out to be a bit nerve-wracking because she was the only artist on the project chosen that late in the game that I'd never had any experience with. It didn't help that she was so young that she'd never even seen an alien film, or that she was driven to do good work on this at-home project that lasted until Sunday morning. That said, Shelton's sample pieces were tight, I was confident that the Colonial Marines would stick around for the entire weekend as scheduled, and I wanted her to have the time she needed. As it turned out, that was the correct course of action. I thought Spunkmeyer was a rather pretty young man with very distinctive features and piercing eyes that Shelton could best capture. Spunkmeyer was a fairly minor player in the film, and actor Daniel Cash seemed to embrace that status, not even taking a proper chair or his own microphone at the furthest end of the table during the cast panel at the con. When I approached him with the commission explaining that this was the last finished piece and the concluding signature on the project, Cash jumped at the comment as an opportunity for self-deprecation along the lines of, "Everybody always picks me last. The shame of it is, Toni Shelton drew a leading man, the image of a hero in this narrative that reflected Cash's anecdotes about his self-image while auditioning for the role before Jim Cameron and Gail Ann Hurd." I complimented Cash on his straight from the hip, no BS interviews, and entertainingly surly attitude. But at the same time, I felt bad that he didn't seem able to see himself at his best 30 years past, as captured in Shelton's appealing work.
This is my first job. It was one of my first auditions ever. I had broken my leg, and I came in on a crutches, and I was in a waiting room, and Al Matthews was pushing people around in a very tough way, and I was scared out of my mind. And then I walked in, and I actually went up for Bill's part. I wanted to be a classical theater actor, so to be honest, I was like, I don't want to be in this movie thing right now. And so I walked in, and there was two very young people running the camera, and I said, listen, this is written for a black man, you need to rewrite this. This writing just doesn't work, just do something better, and then call me back. Kind of cool coat that was in fad at the time in England. And I got 3 recalls for that thing, and then I finally got the part. The people that I was pushing around were James Cameron and Gail Ann Hurd. So I guess it counts to be cocky at some point. You're like, also, he said, you can have the part if you give me the coat.
That leads into number 10, Swarm, by the same creative team. I believe that's the only time that happens. And it's one of those bogus cliffhangers where it's resolved immediately into the start of the next chapter. So you completely dissipate all the tension. Essentially, Attax, once the alien queen landed, he just killed her and is just standing there gloating afterwards. Here we get the introduction of the Mantis aliens. And the cliffhanger on this one is that Ripley gets trapped in a carrier with a bunch of impregnated colonists, and then the ship flies away.
Look, man, I only need to know one thing. Where they are.
Go back, skit.
Anytime, anywhere, man.
Right, right. Somebody said alien. She thought they said illegal alien and signed up.
Fuck you, man.
Anytime, anywhere.
Are you finished?
As a minor Marvel UK fan, I was on board to pre-order Death's Head 2 for both of its solicitations, based on my past experience with the cheesier original version of the character and the tiny but rad-looking sketch of the new Chromium Age version used in the copy. I was blown away when the miniseries finally did come out, drawn by an exciting new find, Liam Sharp, who combined the flash of Jim Lee with the sinewy punk rock Frazetta feel of Simon Bisley. I kept up with Sharp from then on, to Frontier, Verotic, and wherever. When I heard he was coming to town, I knew I had to get a piece, and it seemed obvious he should do the toughest of the Colonial Marines. I liked Vasquez straight away when I saw Aliens 35 years ago, and she's since become a cultural icon. Despite the actress being Jewish, my Mexican girlfriend bought her as one of her own, and dismissed the recent PC police murmurings about whitewashing. It would be an issue today, but in 1985 England, not so much. I had some ideas about how Sharp's take might turn out, maybe emphasizing action and employing her smart gun. I was very happily surprised to see him offer a more pensive Vasquez, staring out from some sort of fence or barrier. The approach emphasized her humanity over being the smack-talking Valkyrie that usually comes to mind, recalling her deep affection for her comrades and her penchant for self-sacrifice in their defense, not to mention her defiant resignation during the final assault on the Marines' stronghold.
Now, her, I remember.
Yeah.
What is her actual actor's name?
Okay, she's Jeanette Goldstein. Besides playing Vasquez, which I would definitely say is her biggest part, I think most people know her as Vasquez.
So Jeanette
Goldstein, yes. She also was in Titanic. She's another one who's in a lot of Cameron's movies. After this, she's probably best known as John Connor's foster mom in Terminator 2 Judgment Day.
Mm-hmm.
So she's done a lot of different accents. She's played a lot of different types of characters. And we took the piece to her, and she was pretty enthusiastic about the piece.
Yeah, so I have to say, like, and that day, I was wearing a Poland shirt.
We'd gone to Poland, I think, the previous year or something.
Yeah, just a simple flag with the word Poland. I normally don't talk to these people, you know, because I just let Frank do it all the talking because that's what he likes. I'm really not, like, excited about these people. Like, oh my God, I have to meet them. The only one that I was with Weaver, and I didn't have the chance. But anyhow.
I took the page up to the actress who played Vasquez, who expressed the most enjoyment and interest of any of the cast members toward these commissions. She asked questions about who the artist was and what the image represented, as well as admiring his technique. I kept the Sharp piece in hand for more of both Space City Con and Kongpalooza than any other piece, and it generated the most comments from the other artists. Goldstein tried to take a cell phone pic of the art, but I happened to have a Xerox of it handy, so it was nice to offer her a souvenir of Houston in reciprocity for signing my stuff. I have to say my best experience with the Aliens cast was with Jeanette Goldstein, and she's still a favorite.
She looks at me in the face, and then she looks down on my shirt, and then she just kind of say with this, you know, weird tone, like nothing in insulting, nothing of any sort, but she just looked at me strange, and it was like, you don't look like a Poland. And so I look at her, and she just kind of took it in such a weird way. It's like, that's a random thing to say, and I remember about the shirt, and I just look right into her eyes, and I'm like, and you don't look like a Vasquez, because people, you know, I'm Hispanic. So, and then she just started laughing, and I'm like,
it was your timing on that was excellent. We were all laughing. Being a Goldstein, there's a good chance she might have been a Poland while she was playing a Vasquez. So it was a perfect, like, back and forth, you know. It was great. So
yeah.
That's probably my single most memorable interaction because of that Cracker Jack timing, you know. It just came right out. And I'm sorry, but I don't, we've had this discussion, you're not one of the people that tends to make me laugh very often, unfortunately, but that was definitely a zinger.
Well, I did make her laugh too.
And she really enjoyed the piece.
Yes, and she's actually very nice. I really like
her. Was very nice, yes.
And that's what I'm saying. You know, when I compare it to the other people who are interacting very nice to you and they're very open, she was very, very nice. I really like her.
So I didn't have an agent. I was a theater actress, and I saw a call for a film called Aliens, and they were looking for a North American and American actors who held a British equity card. And in England, if you have your green card, it's called your resident alien. So I sort of thought, well, what's this film about? You know, I'd seen Alien, it was, you know, just didn't cross my mind that it would be a sequel, so I thought, well, maybe no, they want American actors, maybe it's about a film about how Americans marry British people on the sly to get their resident alien. So I absolutely think the problem was that. So I, you know, I had a first meeting with Gail, and I dressed, which I figured was appropriate for a meeting, and I was pair of slacks and pumps and like a little sort of blouse, and it was a warm day, so I had bare arms. And then actually I saw the poster of Terminator on the wall behind me, and I was like, cool poster, where'd you get it? You know, I had no idea. Like a red rose, we made that film. And then my mind was like, oh my god, I'm wearing the wrong thing completely. Oh my god. But she said, so there's a lot of Marines, and then I said, well, then I make muscle. And so that was the best shape of my life at that point. And she said, oh my god, you're an actor, so you're a bodybuilder? I said, no, I'm an actress, but I like going to the gym a lot. And so she said, okay, well, come back and dress appropriately this time. So I just, straightened my hair back and I came back in combat boots. And I was reading for, I was given the sides of, the lines of Vasquez, and was told you're not auditioning for her because we're casting in the U.S. But there's not as many lines for the pilot to see his part. But I came back and I read it as Vasquez because I didn't know how to read. How do you read something that's not the person? And they kept having me come back. And then actually gave me Hudson's role to read. And again said, you're not playing him, but we just want to hear you read the role of Hudson. So then I read it as Hudson. And then it was very confusing. And I kept coming back. And then finally, this young couple, who I had no idea who they were, I was kind of confused, had me keep reading for Vasquez and talking to me. And then they said, well, we want you to be in the film, but we're not sure who it is. So you're in the film, and we'll call you in a couple of weeks. And I was, I was so excited to have a job before I was 30, so I was over the moon. And then took Jim a while to go back to Fox and kind of explain to them that, this was his choice, and I'd never, done a film. And then I got the role of Vasquez, which is...
Leading into number 11, Terror Dome. The only difference with this one is the inker is now credited as Billy Ray Merriman. I'm wondering if that's the same Bill Merriman that did the Damage series at DC at the time. In the previous chapter, it looked like it was Ripley alone on this carrier, but it turns out most of the Space Marines are with her. They're battling giant facehuggers, and they even find a little girl stand-in for Newt. Her mommy and daddy have been captured by monster rhinos.
Tom! What?
Tom, get over here! We got a live one!
You're gonna be all right. You're gonna be all right.
Please. Kill me.
Just stay calm. We're gonna get you out of here.
It's gonna, we gotta survive. Okay.
It's gonna be all right. Give me a hand. We gotta get her out of here.
What is it, Dieter? What's going on?
Convulsion!
It's a get back!
Damn it!
I got as many of these Colonial Marines commissions finished at Space City Comic Con as I could manage, because I didn't want to juggle turning around pieces at the same show where I was also trying to get cast signatures. It might have been sweet to have had Dietrich Smith draw Corporal Cynthia Dietrich instead of Carter Burke for the jam piece, but since the jam pieces for the most part didn't pan out, I was left to have to scramble to get a piece for the actress Cynthia Scott to sign. Not wanting to take any chances, I approached Chris Beaver, who has always done good work for me. Here he thinks outside the box, going for a landscape, waist-up, action-heavy image. I'm of the hallway recalling the ruined Hadley's Hope and how the flamethrower's light bleaches out much of the surrounding area and the Xenomorph warrior's midsection, a choice rendering, and a turnabout on the infamous Mars Attacks trading card Burning Flesh. Dietrich was the first Marine taken out by the Xenomorphs from behind in an ambush. When I showed it to her actress, Cynthia Scott, I think we were both happy to see Dietrich finally get the chance for some payback.
I don't actually remember with whom I met first. I just remember what must have been my callback. I was, as the rest of us, most of us were living in England, in London, and I was living in a squat, a licensed squat with flatmates, and I rode a bike as my transportation, and I remember my flatmate knocking on my door, and I opened my bedroom door, and he's standing with a befuddled expression on his face and a big, thick envelope. He said, "This just arrived for you by motorbike messenger from 20th century." That's my sides. My first job, too. I do remember, and I think they read all the women at that point for Vasquez, with Vasquez's lines. And so I read the sides and studied up, and I guess I had a little more information than Jeanette had at the time. And I realized, okay, this is like super fit, like buff, threatening woman. So I went to the gym before the audition. And I already had pretty short hair, that helped. And I rode my bike to the audition through Trafalgar Square, which is taking your life in your hands. And I rode like a bad health, like aggressively, like, "Get out of my way! Come look at the buses!" And I only remember, I think that was it. I think I got cast.
That leads into the grand finale, this time done by John Nadal on his own, titled Ice Storm. Bishop gets his arm ripped off and reports on the biggest, baddest aliens we've seen so far. We once end up on a grassy field. I don't know what it is with Nadal and grassy fields, but Bishop puts on a power loader, teams up with Attax in his full armor. They go out to try to save the colonists. It's even more firmly established in this one than any other ones that Attax is supposed to be the cocky jerk, but they save the day and the end.
Yo, Hicks. I think we got something here.
Talk to me, Frosty.
Let's keep moving, baby.
It's moving.
Which way?
It's coming straight forward. Straight up.
One of the ways I regulate my spending and exposure on art commissions is to only get pieces at local shows for cash money, which I tried to do with this Frost piece. I considered having Joe Jesko do the job at Space City, but here was another Colonial Marine I was wishy-washy about whether or not would take part in a jam, and the clock ran out. Also, I had my heart set on getting a piece by Adrian Nelson, who I could usually rely on to appear somewhere at Space City each year. I reached out to him on Twitter, only to learn that he was skipping all the local shows that year to focus on finishing a graphic novel for Kickstarter and another work-for-hire job besides. I couldn't fault him for that, especially because I feel he's one of the strongest local talents to transition into sequential art publications, and I'm still surprised he hasn't done work for a top publisher. I still really wanted him to be a part of the project and broke most of my rules by paying him over the internet for a commission I'd received by meeting him in a McDonald's parking lot partway across town. It was worth it, though, as we had a long chat about his potential in comics and his clear influences from greats like Michael Golden, Jason Pearson, and Greg Capullo, in no way interfering with him having developed his own distinctive and dynamic style. Nelson wasn't comfortable with doing likenesses, and initially struggled with getting the piece started over concerns about that aspect. Once I let him know that it wasn't a big deal for me, Nelson cut loose, focusing on Frost's attitude instead of reference materials. Despite never having drawn a xenomorph before, Nelson went whole hog, incorporating them into his complex design for the piece. The results were splendid, and while Rico Ross is too suave a dude to make a scene over it, he sure enough got a good cell phone snap of the piece all the same.
Adrian Nelson is the artist of the piece, and I think he did a really extraordinary job. He usually does. I've gotten multiple commissions from him, and he's a very passionate and very talented artist. And I think he produced one of the very best pieces out of this assortment. And so I take it to the actor, Rico Ross. This is the thing he's known for. I'm sure he's done a few other things, but he's pretty much just Frost. And unfortunately, Frost is one of the guys who gets killed fairly early on. He's killed during the big massacre of the majority of the Colonial Marines. And so I bring in this piece where the art looks cool, the drawing is sweet, and I think he was really, really happy with it and very impressed by it. The character, of course, didn't get... He wasn't even in Newt's Tale because the character was already dead roughly around at the same time. He might have gotten like a few panels and that was it. So I think that it was a rare opportunity for the actor to see himself in this light, and I think he was very enthused by it. And I was very happy for him and, of course, happy with the piece.
I was a little bit like Danny. I think I walked in there and the only thing bigger, taller than me was my ego. You know, I walked in... I had been auditioning a lot for movies. At that time, I was living in London. I had already auditioned for Full Metal Jacket, and they were very interested. So when I walked in for Aliens, and you got to keep in mind, Jim Cameron wasn't the Jim Cameron that everybody knows at that point. So nobody knew him. And when I saw the movie Alien, I thought it interesting concept, but I was really interested in this Full Metal Jacket because it was Stanley Kubrick, and every actor at that time wanted to work with Stanley Kubrick. So I met with him, and he had me read Higgs and Hudson's role, but he said the same thing. He said, but you're not going to be casting those roles. Which wasn't a nice thing to say to me with my ego, you know. So now I'm thinking, well, I can't believe this now, but I told him at that time, I said, well, if it's not for Higgs or Hudson, I'm really not interested. And he said, well, listen, I'll tell you this. I want you to be in the movie. I just can't tell you right now. We're just starting the cast, but I do want you to be in the movie. And he says, I'll rewrite the script, and I'll write you a nice role, and I'll put some characters together, and you'll be happy. So I went away, and he said, before you accept the Kubrick job, just meet with me again. So I went back to Kubrick. I told him what was happening, and Kubrick says, well, listen, I need you for 8 weeks. And I went back to James, and James, he needs me for 8 weeks. And James said, well, I'll let you come a week late to our shoot if Kubrick will release you. I went, great, I can do both of these movies. Anyway, I went back to Kubrick, and Kubrick says, nah, I can't release you, though. I can't guarantee you. Well, most of you who know Stanley Kubrick, his film, that film took over a year to make, Full Metal Jacket. And so now I understand why he couldn't release me after 8 weeks. anyway, it forced me to make a choice, and James says, listen, I'll rewrite this script. I wrote this script. I'll make you happy. And he says, I'll pay you your fee. Whereas Kubrick didn't want me to read the script. Nobody read the script for Kubrick's film. You got the size, and he says, what we do is we're going to go and we're going to workshop it, and whatever you bring to it is what we're going to bring out of it. And as an actor, you like that challenge. But you don't know what you're going to be doing, you know, and that's a little scary. So I kind of like had to make a choice, and I went with James, and the rest is history.
These steel-jawed beasts have a hunger for destruction. Can they be stopped by the ultimate galactic hunter?
Predator!
The battle is on. Aliens versus Predator, the hunter against the beast. An alien killer crab attacks, but the Predator crack tusk fires shoulder mount missiles, yeah! And Predator scavenge attacks with a double-barreled bola, each sold separately. Will the Predator win the battle against the evil aliens? Aliens versus Predator! Get a special 2-pack with an exclusive Dark Horse comic.
There was a 13th comic that is largely unrelated to these, titled Alien vs. Predator, The Ultimate Battle. It is number 13, so it's technically part of the series, but in terms of story, completely unrelated aside from the presence of the aliens. This one was written by Dan Thorsland, penciled by Brandon McKinney, and inked by Carl Kessel. Joe Phillips still did the cover, but it really doesn't look like a Phillips cover. It feels like it's maybe unfinished, very rough looking. I'm just going to read the plot summary from Xenopedia. On an unknown planet, the Cracktusk Predator leads his clan of Yautja on a hunt for the only creature that is a match for them, the aliens. After flushing a hive out with fire, Crack Tusk announces the beginning of the hunt. Renegade, a young blood, is searching the jungle before being ambushed by a drone. The drone quickly disarms Renegade, but this only angers him. The two creatures clash on equal grounds, but a second drone soon emerges. Before the tides could be turned, a predator on a blade fighter appears and incapacitates the drone, leaving Renegade and the first drone in a standoff. This one, I assume, is going to get collected in the inevitable Aliens vs. Predator omnibus, but it's not in my book, so I didn't get the chance to read this one. There are a number of panels taken from it at Xenopedia. Looks all right.
I prefer the term artificial person myself. Is there a problem?
Ripley's last trip out, the artificial person malfunctioned. There were problems, and a few deaths were involved.
I'm shocked. Was it an older model?
Yeah, the Hyperdyne system's 128-2.
Well, that explains it, and the A2s always were a bit twitchy. That could never happen now with our behavioral inhibitors. It is impossible for me to harm or by a mission of action allow to be harmed a human being. She don't want some...
Just stay away from me, Bishop. You got that straight?
Guess you don't like the cornbread either.
I was really proud of Houston's biggest and longest-lived comic show to score the coup of the majority of the surviving Aliens cast ahead of its 30th anniversary, until SDCC did the same thing a few months later, closer to the actual anniversary, then added James Cameron, Lance Henriksen, and Gail Ann Hurd just for spite. Comicpalooza's never tried anything on that scale again, settling for being a purely regional attraction. Given how much money I spent to get all those autographs, I'm not entirely sorry about that. Still, this was a rewarding effort, and I am building a substantially larger portfolio of commissions to celebrate one of the few movies more beloved to me than this one. At least the H's Convention Bureau made up for the absence of everyone's favorite fully functional synthetic, the Android Bishop. They brought in Lance Henriksen the following year, and at the same show, I tried out a new artist in Kira Morphis. She was either an art student or recent graduate, and her portfolio had some really interesting stuff in it. I had my copy of the Souvenir magazine for reference, and she took it to work on overnight. Wanting to get a better feel for the likeness, she pulled up additional reference online, printed on heavy stock color paper, and did warm-up sketches on one of the pages. She's really nervous when presenting me the final piece, but she needn't have been, as I was very impressed with her take on the late film Bisected Android and the clear attention to detail. Note the serial number on his inner arm, for instance. Never underestimate how many cool applications an artist can come up with for whiteout. In my haste to get the finished piece to the actor to sign, he was appropriately gravelly, I forgot my souvenir book, which Morphis held on to for a year before returning to me at the next Comicpalooza. A class act, and not the first time an artist has gone above and beyond for me in this manner. They're good people.
I think I might remember him a little bit,
yeah.
But not really.
Yeah, so again, this was the straggler. This is the one who wasn't in Houston. Like, while it would be cool to get something of Jim Cameron, he wasn't one of the characters, you know? He wasn't one of the actors. And so I'm not as worried about getting a piece, you know, or anything, any interaction with Jim Cameron. But Bishop is one of the coolest characters in the movie. He's one of the heroes of the movie. And he's also, after Sigourney Weaver, the actor who's been in the most Alien movies and done the most within the universe. In some ways, he's as important or more important than the character of Ellen Ripley because of the various incarnations of Bishop and
his roots within the corporation. And I've been a fan of the actor for years. He's just a cool dude, cool, great voice and cool attitude. He's done a bunch of camera stuff as well as a bunch of horror movies and such. So I was looking forward to seeing him. And what had happened was my buddy Fixit, after one of his signings, had found a discarded 8x10 with a squiggle thing that didn't look like a signature at all. And he gave it to me. And it's nice of him to give it to me, but I felt bad about having it because I felt like it was stolen property, basically. It's like, well, what am I doing with this signed piece that didn't belong to me? And so I get in line for Lance Henriksen. I get up to him and I say, hey, listen, a friend of mine found this and I gave it back to him. And he's like, oh yeah, that's one of the ones that the pin, I was testing the pin on. So he just tosses it aside, takes the piece and signs an actual signature because his signature looked nothing like the squiggle that was on the 8x10. So I probably could have kept the jacked up 8x10, but instead I got the finished piece signed, the last of the Aliens 30th anniversary, in this case 31st anniversary. But aside from being grizzled and signing his name, not a lot of interaction. And I didn't see a lot of interaction with other people as well. So he's another fella. I think in his case, there's a greater sense of discomfort. You got a greater sense of maybe he just isn't comfortable around all these people. This is kind of freaking him out a little bit. So it wasn't so much the attitude that you may have gotten from some of the other actors, but definitely wasn't warm to be received either.
I don't think I have like a no vibe at all because I don't remember anything of him. Mm-hmm. If it doesn't make an impact, either positive or negative, I was okay with you.
Yeah.
You didn't do anything to either excite me or piss me off.
Yeah. There was also an attempt to revitalize the Kenner toy line via 1998's Aliens Hive Wars, which was basically the G.I. Joe extreme of the Aliens line. They were exclusive to KB Toys and featured predators within the line. The Space Marines were now all warded up and referred to as the Space Marine Heat Force, H-E-A-T as an acronym. The only member from the original group to carry over into the new one was Corporal Hicks, although suddenly he had an eye patch and looked nothing like Michael Biehn. I guess the plus side is he's not running around saying, "Bad data!" But if Attax was the Poochie of Space Marines, Heat Force is nothing but Poochies. They're led by Tim Capello, the real sexy sax man. I'm only barely joking. This dude's name, Smash Mason. The dude's buff, bare-chested, long-haired, kind of oily. Seriously, if you're picturing the sax man from The Lost Boys, this is him. And his version of leadership is, go get him, kick their butt. Again, you've got Hicks, and I believe he got a Pwn cybernetic arm and his backward ball cap. Weird combo there. They introduce another android. This dude's like full-on robot dude, Joe. He's called Intiker Cubed. I don't know who is coming up with these names. This is awful. They've also got a friendly alien, perhaps enslaved through some sort of cybernetics, since he's got all these weird like tubes and stuff coming out of him. He's called R-Zor, Razor, I suppose. And he talks. It's a Hulk speak.
Smash bug, smash lots of bugs.
And there's essentially no story. It's here's these guys, there's the aliens, go get them, show off as many toys as possible. And they don't even commit to an ending. It's the end, only you can decide. The Kenner Aliens comics that actually did get released are bad in a fun way and almost good. Sometimes they're actually almost good. This is just full on bad. So I'm glad that this particular comic was never released, but you can read the thing in full at the Xenopedia website.
Sigourney read for the part of Hudson.
Hashtag socially distant, Abyssal Albion, Anthony Percanti, Baby Skeletor, Bill from the Bat Pod, Chris Dunford, Chris Lydon, Del Dracula, Doc Strange, The Electric Strawberry, Federico de Virgilis, Green Lantern HG, I'll Be the Light of the Dark, The Hammer Strikes, Geeky Stuff, and Hashtag VoiceOver, History of Comics on Film, Iowa's Joe Crawford, James Chase, Jeffrey Brown, They and Them, Keith G. Baker, King Dinosaur, King Size Comics, John Size Fun Podcast, Michael Wagner, Mike at Send 80s to Me, Monitor Earth Prime, Paint Up Odin, Yen Dwok, Paul K. Bissell, Ralph Lovegrove, Siskoid, Stimbot 5000, Tristan Garbrough, Oofka, Foodzoid, and Sebastian Lapierre Post, Dark Horse Presents Aliens, Goose Tale, 1992, Mike, A Tale as Old as Time, New Mutants, Frying Hole. Finally got around to listening. Sorry, been busy. Totally agree, garbage story. I remember when I got the comics, I was excited because it had some hype, and I thought her story of staying alive was going to rock, and then not so much. All over the place. The sites that list it as one of the best alien stories, have they ever read any, and I mean any other alien stories? Jeffrey Brown. Now this is interesting. I was very aware of these comics when they came out, except for the crossovers with Predator, including the Neo Games, and fighting Batman off and on. I have just finished watching Aliens last weekend and Alien 3.
This has been a Raw Old Spine podcast. All audio samples are believed covered under fair use laws. No copyright infringement is intended.
My question is, what's going on with Alien 5?